The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
All right, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a live show for you today, March 9th. And with us today to talk about the media and media coverage of economics and politics, among other things, although that covers quite a bit of ground right there, is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Mark Weisbrot is an expert in international economics and also on political economy, and he writes a weekly column on economic and policy issues that's distributed to over 400 papers. I've been reading the column religiously for quite some time, and it is one of the finest columns available in American journalism today. Mark Weisbrot is also the co-author with Dean Baker of The Scorecard on Globalization, 20 Years of Diminished Progress. And finally, Mark Weisbrot is, in fact, has a strong link to our area, to Central Illinois, having gone to college here at the University of Illinois and having spent 10 or 11 years in the Charleston-Urbana metropolitan area. Mark Weisbrot, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. And maybe you should tell people your credentials as an economist before we go any further, since we're going to be talking a lot about economics. You are a trained economist, is that right?
Yes. Yes, I did my PhD at Michigan, actually.
Okay.
And that's mostly what we work on is economic issues, but we do end up doing some things that are more political around foreign policy because our foreign economic policy and our foreign policy are so closely related.
Yeah, I want to talk about the international stuff and the foreign policy stuff, both Venezuela, which I know you've been covering, and you've been down to Venezuela to sort of monitor the situation, and also in Iraq and the potential war in Iraq that certainly dominates everyone's thinking nowadays. But first, let's do a little basics here on the sort of the journalism in general and its coverage of economic issues and talk about some sort of core issues. I mean, we've seen an enormous increase in the past 10 or 15 years in what's called business journalism, the number of reporters, resources devoted to covering the economy. It's become a major story in much of our news media. How would you assess the quality, if you had to generalize, of the reporting on the economy from a public interest perspective?
Well, there are some good reporters and some good reporting. And one of the things for people who are interested, and by the way, all of our stuff is available at cepr.net on the Internet, and one of the things my co-director, Dean Baker, does is every week he puts out a review of all the New York Times and Washington Post business and economics articles and where he goes through a lot of their mistakes. And so there's definite pattern, and there are some big things that the business press has gotten wrong. For instance, they never got the stock market bubble. And this was not a hard thing. As a matter of fact, Dean was one of the first economists, probably the first economist in the United States to actually do the arithmetic of the bubble. You could show this very clearly. The price-to-earnings ratios were at more than twice their historic level. And we're not talking about just the tech stocks or any particular stocks like Microsoft or Intel or certainly the other ones that collapsed like Enron. But the whole market as a whole, the broad market, was at a level that you could show as a matter of arithmetic was inconsistent with any conceivable growth projections, and certainly any growth projections that anybody was accepting at the time, for the economy. In other words, the stock market can't just take any value. In the short run, it can, right? You can have huge bubbles. So in Japan, you had a bubble where the Nikkei stock index was 39,000 in 1989, and today it's around 12,000. That's, 13 years later. It's at less than a third of its value. That's a huge bubble. And there was no telling how big our bubble could have grown before it was going to burst. That wasn't predictable. But you could say, as a matter of arithmetic, that it was a bubble and that it was going to collapse. And so it really was incumbent on the business press to point this out, because the recession that we've just had in 2001 and the one that we're probably about to have, the primary cause of that is really the collapse of this bubble, the disappearance of, $7 or $8 trillion of wealth. And this was completely predictable and predicted, and yet the press had almost nothing on it. And that's really big to miss something like that.
Especially when you've got thousands and thousands of journalists covering it.
Yes, and millions of people who have the bulk of their retirement savings in the stock market, and who, many of whom, depending on when they got in, but especially the ones that got in towards the peak, near the peak of the bubble, have really ruined their retirement. And this was an issue that they could have grasped if they had taken maybe a half hour to look at the arithmetic, or probably 10 or 15 minutes even, and could have written about. And really, almost none of them did.
No, now that you mention it, Mark, I recall your colleague Dean Baker writing a column on this, I believe, in 1999, making this very point. And what struck me then was I saw nothing. I mean, he was just a voice in the wilderness. Absolutely no one else was talking in these terms.
Yes, and we had a lot of them. I had columns in the L.A. Times and all kinds of papers about it. And I talked to, you know, when the bubble started to collapse, you know, I talked to reporters from all the major papers, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and almost all of them had this idea that the stock prices were psychologically determined, and therefore you couldn't really say anything. And I think part of it was you couldn't say anything definitive about whether there was a bubble. I think part of it is, of course, that is true in the short run, but what mattered to all these people who lost their retirement savings was the long run. And that was, you know, the opposite of the truth was being told to all these people who were saving for their retirement. In other words, they were told if they had their money for the long run, they were safe. But in fact, that's exactly where you could say that they were in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And very few of these reporters got it. And of the ones who did, their editors really wouldn't let them write about it. And so I think that was a very big one. And but there's others as well that are huge.
But before we go into those, let me just let our listeners know we're talking with Mark Weisbrot today in Media Matters. Mark Weisbrot's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington and writes a weekly column on economic and policy issues that's distributed to over 400 newspapers. If you would like to call in and ask Mark Weisbrot a question, our number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Right now, we're discussing, in general, some examples of how the news media cover economic issues and some of the weaknesses and limitations of that coverage. We'll be discussing later in the show foreign policy, international affairs, and press coverage of that and how relates to economic issues too, and so please call in. I think any range, any type of question fits within Mark Weisbrot's range. So, Mark, as you were saying about press coverage of the economy, do you want to talk some more examples?
Sure. Well, that was one, and I think it has enormous implications because people still don't understand it today. So they still don't realize that this was a bubble, that it was predictable, that something could have been done about it. They could have simply told the truth about it, like when Greenspan started to tell the truth, for example, in December of 96, and he made that speech about irrational exuberance. All he really had to do, now he backed off of that because he didn't want to burst the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But all he had to do was just explain it to people, and that would have saved us from a lot of the economic trauma, probably all of it, that we're experiencing today.
Let's take a real recent example. President Bush has proposed quite recently a massive tax cut, including the elimination of the tax on dividends. What's your assessment of that as an economist first, and secondly of the coverage of that?
Well, of course, this tax cut is not designed at all to stimulate growth. That's the first thing. And the administration, interestingly, didn't even call it a stimulus on their own website, because it isn't. You don't need to spend $670 billion, that is, in terms of, that's the tax cut on dividends, over a 10-year period in order to stimulate the economy right now. You can take a small fraction of that money for an economic stimulus, and of course, this is highly concentrated as well. This cut goes to probably the upper 10% of the population at most.
The dividend tax cut?
Yes.
Could you explain that a little bit? People might be a little confused, especially those who don't receive dividends, exactly what this means, this eliminating the tax on dividends.
Well, stocks, you know, there's two ways that you get money from holding stocks. One is through a capital gain, and the other is through a dividend payout, which is a share of the company's profit that's paid out to shareholders. And the dividend payout is now taxed as income. And so this would eliminate that tax.
Would it be the elimination on individuals or on the corporations?
No, it would be on the individuals who receive the dividend income from holding stock. Now, the thing is, what most people don't know, and the press has largely missed this, is, first of all, only half the country holds stocks at all, even in retirement accounts. But the thing is that most of those people who hold stock, so half the country doesn't get anything from any of this because they don't hold any stocks at all. But for the half that does, the vast majority hold stocks in retirement accounts. So they won't be affected by this cut because when they draw their money, when they actually retire, so if you have an IRA or a 401k or any of the retirement accounts that allow you to save money tax-free, what you do is you save that money and, you know, it comes out of your paycheck and so you don't have to pay taxes on it. But then you pay the taxes when you retire. So you will have to pay, if you have stocks in your mutual fund or whatever you're saving your money in, you will have to pay that tax when you retire. So the only people who get that tax exemption that the president is proposing are people who own stocks outside of retirement accounts. And those are, of course, among the richest households in the country. So this is really a rewriting, another rewriting of the tax code to redistribute income to the richest households.
Now, the defense of getting rid of the tax on dividends is that dividends are taxed twice, unlike all other forms of
income. Yes, and the press has missed that, too, because they even, in news articles, they even refer it still to as double taxation. But there's actually no legitimate argument for this. So in other words, this is kind of like, you know, the Republicans call the estate tax the death tax, because that sounds more sinister. And so this is the kind of, this is just a public relations thing, but the press has, now they haven't picked up on calling it the death tax because they recognize that, but they didn't get this one.
Well, why isn't it double taxation?
Well, because a corporation is treated in our law as a separate entity. It's like an individual, and so, and there are benefits of having a corporation. So, for instance, you have limited liability. That's the main advantage of incorporating, as opposed to having a proprietorship or a partnership. If you form a corporation, you, as an owner of shares in that corporation, are not liable for anything beyond what you invest in it. That is, you can't be sued for anything that anything beyond that. That's a huge thing. I mean, that's why the corporate form is the dominant form of business organization in the country. So, in other words, you're paying a tax. The corporation pays a tax because it's a separate entity. And then, of course, it pays its shareholders, and then they get taxed on that income. But that's no more a form of double taxation as to say that the workers, for example, who are being taxed doubly because they're corporation is being taxed, and then their income is being taxed. So you see that you could call that double taxation too, and try and get rid of tax.
So basically, everything is virtually everything is double taxed.
Yeah, it's
by that
a
logic.
Meaningless thing. It's just a kind of a trick, a verbal trick, and the press has not really gotten that.
They What's next? The double wealth tax or double death tax? Then we'll really know we're in trouble.
Right.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot today in Media Matters, the economist and economic journalist. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have phone lines open. The number here, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Champagne, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. When your guest was talking earlier, it reminded me of time I spent in San Francisco in the late 90s where basically it seemed the streets were paved with gold and everyone thought that the stock market was going to go to 36,000. I think that there's some article back then that said Dow 36,000.
Yeah, that was a book.
And what I'm wondering is, since then, of course, there's been quite a bit of discussion of corporate figures having a conflict of interest in such a way as concealing the ill health of their companies. And I'm wondering, are there ways in which journalists became similarly complicit in the story about the bubble? And if so, are there ways that that problem, too, could be addressed in financial reporting in the future? And I don't mean this when I say complicit. I don't really mean it in some sort of sinister or illegal way. But again, going back to my memories of San Francisco then, it seemed that, in a way, anyone who was even remotely involved with those industries, it was kind of part of the game to talk it all up. And there was a lot of benefit for everyone involved in attempting to talk it up. And then, of course, that sort of shields people from then maybe reporting on things accurately or conveying information that broader parts of the population would find useful. So I guess that's my question, and I'll hang up and just listen to your answer then. Thank you.
Okay, Mark?
Yes, I think they could have. I think it would have been a fairly simple thing to just look at the arithmetic of the market. And again, we explain this. It's something that could be explained in a few hundred words. And basically all you have to do is take a look at dividends and capital gains and say, okay, what is the projected, what's the rate of return that you can get that's consistent with the growth of the economy? And, of course, that's what they didn't do, and even though it was presented to them over and over again. And there were very, very few occasional articles that came close to doing that, because there were a couple of prominent people. Robert Shiller wrote that book, Irrational Exuberance, and he got most of the story in there. And so once in a great while that would appear. But this is something that was very, very clear, and they could have simply presented it in a clear manner, and people would have gotten it. I mean, not everybody would have gotten it, but the major investors and institutions would have gotten it right away.
Mark, let me just turn this in a slightly more concrete direction, if I can, which is, during the 1990s, especially the second half of the 1990s, at times it seemed like fast-growing firms were treated with an extraordinary reverence similar to the 1920s in our culture. Enron, for example, I think 6 years running was Fortune magazine's number one most dynamic and innovative company in the U.S. economy. In 2001, the chair of CEO of WorldCom spoke before the National Press Club, or 2000, to the adulation of the press corps, hailed as one of the great geniuses of our time. Now both these companies lie in shambles, enmeshed in scandal. And I was wondering if you could reflect on the corporate scandals. These are just two of them. You know, what happened, the role of the press sort of in the 90s, and then also how good of a job has the press done of covering these scandals since they've broken in the past 18 months?
Yes. Well, obviously they missed an awful lot, and there was a little more. I think there were some articles. There were articles in Fortune magazine, for example, that looked at some of these companies and talked about how they were exaggerating profits. So there was a little more of an understanding on the individual level. But overall, it was pretty bad, as you described. But it wasn't as bad as the misunderstanding of the macro issue, the bubble itself. The coverage since then, I think, has been pretty bad, too. Because, you know, if you look at what happened with the media has basically dropped the ball. You know, there were several reforms that were proposed after Enron collapsed and the corporate crime scandals, were really at their peak in the media. And there were certain basic reforms. One of them was to have some kind of mechanism for independent audits so as to avoid a repeat of, Enron and WorldCom and those huge multi-billion dollar deceptions. And that hasn't happened so far, at least. There was a proposal to prevent companies from putting all of their employees too much of their employees, set a limit on how much of their employees' pension benefits can be put in the company's stock. And that hasn't happened either. And then there was also a proposal to fixed the way companies dealt with stock options to make them deducted as an expense at the time that it's granted. And so those were the three basic reforms that came out of the corporate crime scandal, and none of them have been implemented. And so the press really could have played a role in just pointing that out and making those issues part of what should be talked about. Of course, the administration was very clever about that beginning in last August because of the congressional election. They started making sure that the war was the news all the time. And that succeeded in displacing these issues.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have phone lines open if you'd like to call in. The number is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the press coverage of the economy. And also we're going to turn in the second half of the show to the press coverage of foreign affairs, foreign policy, how it relates to the economy, and otherwise, specifically Venezuela and the war in Iraq or the prospective war in Iraq. Let me take this moment now to give a couple of announcements. First of all, the next three shows of Media Matters, next week, 1 week from today, March 16th, our guests will be Robert Greenwald and Mike Farrell. Robert Greenwald is a Hollywood producer who's made a lot of the films and TV shows you've probably watched over the years. Mike Farrell is the actor who's most notably appeared in MASH for many years. They're going to be talking about celebrities, entertainers, and their role as social critics, specifically with regard to the war now, but also in general. Both of them are very active in progressive political issues. 2 weeks from today, we'll have as our guest Jenny Toomey, the director of the Future of Music Coalition, talking about what's going on in the music industry, what the political and social issues are that affect musicians, and what's being done about it. And then 3 weeks today, the last Sunday in March, our guest will be Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation magazine. We've had many Nation writers on our show over the last year, year and a half. You'll get a chance now to talk to their editor. And she's also an expert on Eastern Europe, Russia specifically, and what's been happening there in the last 10 years. So she can speak with tremendous authority on that subject. So that's our lineup for the month. But our guest today, as I said, is Mark Weisbrot, the economist who spent 10 years living in the Urbana-Champaign, Charleston metropolitan area. And he's here to talk about the economy with us. And we have callers lined up for you, Mark. So let's get back to the phone lines.
Sure.
Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hello. Thank you. I was curious about basically how some economic stories are reported. In particular, I know there's recently an article about a company that moved some jobs out of Champaign, and the person who was being interviewed had claimed that the jobs were moved to another state here in this country, when in fact the jobs were moved to India. And I noticed the reporter just reported it as though he got it from a press release or something and just contacted the president and talked to him. And in the course of reading that, I contacted the Bureau of Labor Statistics to try to find out how many jobs are being lost overseas. And they apparently don't keep records. At least the economist I talked to said they don't keep those records. So I was wondering if you could perhaps tell me, also in light of the fact that unemployment has risen, you know, how do we find out how many jobs are lost to overseas? Who's keeping records? Who's monitoring these things? And in the case of this one story, you know, the reporter didn't really try to do any investigative work, I don't think. So if you could kind of address that, I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. I don't know if anybody actually compiles that number. It's very possible the BLS doesn't do that. And there is a very strong prejudice in the press against, you know, they basically view these things as kind of natural and inevitable workings of a market economy.
You mean job loss or job flight?
Yeah, job loss and job flight is not necessarily seen by them because they kind of adopt the prejudice of the kind of the bulk of economists, which is that these kinds of they see these things as simply what they call comparative advantage, working within an economy and bringing benefits to consumers. And so these things are reported in a very prejudiced way, because after all, you know, these are really policy decisions. It isn't just the market. You know, we have all these treaties like NAFTA, like the WTO agreements that were designed deliberately to throw workers in the United States into competition with the lowest wage labor in the world. And it took a lot of work to be able to do that. And of course, they don't, and this is something we're always pointing out in the, you know, in the criticism of the press, is that the same thing could be done with doctors, for example. You know, you have doctors in the United States are paid about twice of what their counterparts in the western parts of Europe are paid. And so you could bring benefits to consumers by simply training doctors in other countries with a lot less trouble than it took to create the WTO or even NAFTA. You could increase the supply of qualified doctors in the United States and drive those salaries down rather than driving the salaries of the median worker down to very low levels and getting rid of those jobs. And you could have free trade in that kind of service, and it would save consumers probably 10 or 20 times as much as they save from the so-called, what they call free trade in goods and services. And yet that's not done because doctors are strong enough as a group to restrict the number of doctors and to prevent that from happening. But the majority of the population in our democracy does not have enough clout to prevent that from being done to them. So that's the process that's really taking place. And the press doesn't see it that way. They see it as kind of the inevitable result of technological changes and market forces, which is really a gross distortion of what's happening.
Do you think we could even extrapolate from that and go somewhat further? I suspect you can. You've written on this widely about the way the news media in general tend to cover all these trade deals, like the formation of the WTO and WTO negotiations and NAFTA. I mean, is there problems that this is representative of that deal with all these sort of trade issues and how they're covered and portrayed in the news media?
Oh, absolutely. And I've been on the air with journalists a number of times, you know, and I've gotten them to admit that it's wrong to call any of these free trade agreements, for example, like NAFTA was not a free trade agreement. And this is not a trivial thing because the WTO, for example, is not a free trade organization or a free trade agreement because one of the biggest and most important parts of the WTO is to enforce U.S. patent law outside of the United States, patent and copyright law. And this is a huge, huge thing, not only in monetary terms. If it's implemented, according to the World Bank's estimates, this would cost developing countries more than any benefits that they would get from access to the markets of the rich countries for their exports. So, but not only that, I mean, you can see it's become a huge issue because of the AIDS crisis. You have 36 million people in the developing countries that are HIV positive or have AIDS, and very, very few, almost none of them, will be able to be treated at the cost of the patent-protected drugs that cost $10,000 a year, the anti-AIDS drugs. And they are producible now for $200 or $250 a year. And that's the kind of free trade. I mean, this is exactly free trade you're talking about that they're trying to prevent. In other words, free international competition in life-saving pharmaceuticals. That's what they are actually fighting against. And it's the major, if you had to look at what is the major foreign commercial policy objective of the United States right now, you would have to say that that's it, is to enforce these patents, these monopolies.
So it's protectionist, not...
Completely. It's by economic definition, it's protectionism. The only difference between this form of protectionism and a tariff is that, first, it's collected by a private company rather than by the government. So it's a private monopoly rather than a government one. And second, that it's much greater. So the, you know, typical tariff rarely raises prices by more than 20 or 30%, whereas the monopoly, the protectionism enforced through the corporations and through their patent rights can raise prices by hundreds or even thousands of percentage points.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple of callers I'm going to get to in a second. If you'd like to call in and ask Mark Weisbrot a question, the number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Urbana, line 2, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Yes, thanks. First, I'd like to compliment Mark because I've been a fan of his work. And my question mainly is, where is a good place to go to get this information? You know, what's the least biased access of news other than your own website, which I frequent once in a while? But I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, depending on the issue, I mean, there are a lot of organizations now. You know, Public Citizen, for example, citizen.org, does a lot of work on these trade agreements, if that's what you're referring to.
Well, let's say you're a person, Mark, who doesn't have a lot of time, but has access to the Internet, and they sort of want to, like, you know, be able to get up to speed on, like, a critique of the dividend tax cut plan or elimination plan, or of the stock market bubble, or of corporate scandals. Just sort of get another perspective on these major economic issues that's different from the consensus coming out of the mainstream news media. Where would you recommend they go?
I think our thing on the Economic Reporting View, which you can get by email just by going to our website, that's cepr.net, that is a really nice weekly summary because it really takes all of these issues that are being reported every day by the, you know, the two most influential papers in the country, the New York Times and the Washington Post, and says, you know, this is what they've gotten wrong. And that really does clarify a lot, I think.
And I should tell our listeners that if you don't have a pen handy, you're not writing this down or you're spacing it out, if you want, you can get a weekly email sent to you by our producer. We will tell you who our guests are on the show and give these links in the email. So you wouldn't have to ever write this down. You can just go to it from the email, click to it for Mark Weisbrot's website, for example. And if you're interested in getting these weekly emails, all you have to do is go to my own website, robertmcchesney.com, and you'll see right there on the homepage a thing you click on that will set you up to get this once a week. And, of course, you'll get no commercial messages. We'll only send you one. You can get off anytime you want. But we have several hundred people now, apparently, who have signed up for it and seem to be happy with it. So I'd urge you to consider doing that if you want to get the sort of information, don't want to keep a pen by your side when you're listening to our show. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Yeah, thanks. I'm had to get away from my radio, so if you could keep me on when I get an answer. But your first caller was talking on the other side of the issue that I'd like to ask a question about, and he was saying how many jobs we've lost. Well, recently there was a lady that knew something about the steel industry in Brazil, and she was talking about how the tariffs are so high importing into the U.S. that they are kind of forced to pay their people, you know, very little. Now, I know that's a mixed situation, that there are, you know, people there who are getting rich at the same time, but my question is, I don't understand where I can find, this is another resource question, where I can find data on present tariffs. I mean, like, if I wanted to find out how much, what the tariff is on steel coming from Brazil or anywhere else or any other item, where can I go?
I think the Commerce Department has some of that data on their website. That's all I can tell you right off the top of my head. If you want more info, if you can't find it right away and you call our office on Monday, we'll have somebody try and find it for you.
Okay. Well, I wanted you to, at least I was hoping you'd comment on whether or not my point of view has some merit to it, because I very often hear about trade on a whole different bunch of levels, and every once in a while, people will mention how high our tariffs are.
Well, our tariffs are not very high at all. As a matter of fact, if you go to the Economic Report of the President, which just the latest version just came out, which has very good data tables, that's another source where you can find at least the overall figures, not necessarily on particular industry. But you'll see the tariff, the amount of, we're well under 2% in terms of our tariffs, our average tariffs. And so we have among the lowest tariff barriers in the world. And that's why, you know, this whole push to say, well, the rich countries simply have to open up their markets to the goods of the poor countries is quite an exaggeration. There isn't that much to open, first of all, and the benefits aren't that great. And we did a paper on this, too. You can see this on our website, just looking at the standard economic literature on what are the gains that countries would actually get if the poor country, if you had removed all tariff barriers in Europe and Japan and all the rich countries and the United States. And it turns out to be very little. For example, the World Bank's data show, you know, their estimate, and they're very much in favor of this, of course, because they support complete opening to trade everywhere. And their estimate of what the gains to the poorer countries would be, which they don't highlight, but it's in their report, if they phased in everything that they wanted and eliminated all barriers to the merchandise exports of the low- and middle-income countries, that's agriculture, steel, textiles, everything, the gain after phased in after 11 years, you'd have about a 0.6% increase in income or GDP. So in other words, a country in Africa that had a per capita income of $500 today would have $506 per person 11 years from now. So these are very small gains, and it's been grossly exaggerated because the dominant view from these powerful institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, and of course the media basically follows their views, is that, you know, we should open up all markets in the world. And what really needs to be done rather than that, I think, is to allow the poorer countries to make their own policies. That is, if they want to protect their own agriculture from the subsidized agriculture of the United States, then they should be able to do that. If they want to let in the cheap food that the U.S. produces, then they should be able to do that. And rather than just trying to make one rule for everyone, which, of course, we didn't have when we were a developing country, we didn't have to follow those kinds of rules, right? We had tariffs, you know, all the way up to, it was an average of 44% on our manufactured goods all the way up to the First World War. And so our view is that countries need more ability to set their own economic policies in order to develop their own industry and agriculture. And it's not so much a question of just freeing all markets in the world, because that has had a devastating impact over the last 20 years.
Well, I look forward to looking into it and maybe giving your office a call Monday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot today on Media Matters. We have lines open if you'd like to call in. The number is 333-9455 and the toll-free number 800-222-9455. Mark, I'd like to sort of turn the discussion, if we could now, to Venezuela. As I recall, you've been down to Venezuela this year already. Is that correct?
That's right. Well, it was actually in December.
In December, okay. Could you give our listeners, some of whom might not be that familiar with what's happening there, because it doesn't really get a lot of coverage in the press now, a little summary of what's been taking place in Venezuela over the past year and your assessment of the situation?
Well, over the past year, there's been two or three major efforts by the opposition to topple the government. One was a military coup in April, and that was supported by the United States. And it was really, I think, the first time probably in decades that our government actually, even though they've been involved in a number of coups, for example, the CIA was involved in the coup of Haiti in 1991, and even orchestrated coups, they never, almost never endorse it publicly, because this is a democratically elected government, and no one disputes that. I mean, Jimmy Carter was down there for all the elections and everything, and Carter Center verified the results. And so there was a military coup against the government led by officers who were trained at the School of the Americas and, you know, run by the United States. And, of course, there was a lot of U.S. Links to the coup as well. And our government actually endorsed it. And then they had to take that back under international pressure. And, you know, since this show is about the media, I should say that one of the most disgraceful things was the New York Times endorsed the coup. And this I can't remember. I mean, in the last 28 years that I've read that paper, I've never seen them do anything like this. And they were also embarrassed. In fact, there was a member of the editorial board who was there for 14 years who called me just to vent his anger and shame over this, that the New York Times had actually, on April 12th, endorsed the overthrow of a democratically elected government. But it shows the deep media prejudice on this issue. And then the following Tuesday, they took it back in an editorial where they said, they didn't apologize or anything, but they said that some people endorsed this coup, including us, and nobody should ever support the overthrow of a democratically elected government. So, but then nobody made a big thing out of that. But anyway, so that was one effort, and that failed because I think mainly because the people who organized the coup didn't have the wherewithal or perhaps even the willingness to do what they did in Chile, I think, in 1973, which is to kill thousands of people and round them up and throw them in jail and drive them into exile. And so people came out into the streets to defend their elected president. Some were shot, but for the most part, the military responded by restoring the president to power. And then the second attempt.
Well, can I before you go to the second attempt, Mark? What is the concern that the people who attempted the coup have with the elected Chavez government? Why are they so upset with this government, and are their concerns justified?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I have about 300 emails sitting in my mailbox, going great length, some 20 pages or longer, listing those concerns because I wrote a long piece for the Washington Post. In January, which was probably the first time in the U.S. media that anybody gave the other side of the story, that is, you know, said, why do people support Chavez? So I have a long list of all the things they say, and it's very hard to answer that question for them. I mean, they will tell you all the things they don't like about him. But it is very hard, I should say, it's hard to point to anything concrete that he's done to hurt them. So he hasn't really increased their taxes. There hasn't been any land reform yet that took anything away from anyone, at least any significant amount of people, or even a significant amount of redistribution. So you can't point to any one thing, you know, like you can in other situations where the government undertakes, you know, like Mugabe in Zimbabwe, for example. You can't point to anything that that he did. Why do they hate him so much? If you ask them, they usually talk about he's friendly with Castro. He's going to turn the country into a dictatorship. He stirs up people with class resentment, they'll say, which to some extent he does, in the sense that he does talk about the poverty, and you know the majority of Venezuelans are poor. And he emphasizes that, and he does mobilize people, but he's never incited anyone to violence or anything, although they'll accuse him of that. It's very hard to say, to point to a concrete economic interest that's been hurt or any kind of oppression. You know, there are no political prisoners in the country. There were warrants recently issued for two prominent people, one the head of the Chamber of Commerce and the other the head of the Central Labor Federation, who has, you know, been involved in both of these attempts to overthrow the government, one the military coup and secondly the strike, the oil strike and business lockout.
Now, when was the oil strike and business lockout?
That was 63 days from December, beginning December 2nd or so.
And that was an effort basically to shut down the economy and force the government to relent?
Yeah, and forced Chavez to resign as president. And
that didn't work, I take it?
No, that didn't work either. And the one thing people should know is that was not a labor strike or a general strike at all. It was an oil strike led by the management of the oil company, with workers, too. Most of the blue-collar workers didn't participate, but the technical and other workers did. But it's a tiny percentage of the labor force, and this is something that the press missed entirely, and that is that, they very often, although the Times changed their reporting after a while, but they very often reported as though it were a general strike, and it was very hard to find, if you were there, as I was, at the peak of this strike, you couldn't find workers on strike outside the oil industry. You had businesses locking out their workers, but you didn't find workers who voluntarily voted to support this strike. So it was a strike led by the Business Federation and then the management of the oil company. And, you know, we've written a lot about this. And in fact, this week we've got a paper on the oil industry itself, because that's a huge part of the battle, is you have this management who supports the United States goals on the running of the oil company. You've got to remember, this is one of the biggest oil exporters in the world, or it was until last year and will be again as it recovers. And, you know, the management wanted to bust the OPEC quotas, produce 6 million barrels a day of oil instead of 3, you know, privatize the company, all the things that Washington wanted. And Chavez was fighting to get control over it. It's a state-owned company, and so it should be run by the government. And, in fact, it should be used to generate revenues for the government. And so this is a big part of what the battle was about. It's very much like Iraq in that sense, that a big part of the struggle and the reason why the United States has tried to overthrow this government is to gain control over the oil resources of the country.
What's your sense of where things stand in Venezuela today and in the coming months, weeks, months, and even years?
Well, I think now the oil strike is dead, and I think the government has consolidated its power. I think, you know, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen, but the opposition is pretty much in disarray after the end of that strike. They've tried, as I said, two other major ways. They can't win an election. That's their problem. They've lost 5 elections since 1998, and so they've resorted to these extra legal means to try and get rid of the government, and both of those have failed. And one thing, you know, this is another thing, you know, in terms of media coverage. You know, when I was down there, I spoke with every major reporter, New York Times, The Post, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, Miami Herald. Every single reporter, every one of them, AP, they all agreed that people in the United States have a completely false impression of the situation in Venezuela. And on two issues in particular, they agreed. One was that they think the country is a dictatorship, which it isn't. And I think Chavez really proved this, you know, in terms of his commitment to democracy. You know, the media always mentions that he led a attempted military coup himself in 92, which is true, and he spent 2 years in jail for it. But since he entered the political arena in elections, he has played by the rules. And he allowed what no Western democracy would allow, that 63-day strike. I mean, we have laws against that. You cannot cripple the economy with a strike in the United States. First of all, in the public sector, you're not allowed to strike at all, as Reagan showed when he fired 12,000 air traffic controllers. So you'd be fired right there. But we also have Taft-Hartley, which is invoked and has been invoked many times to prevent people from destroying the economy in a strike. And thirdly, you don't have the right, even in the private sector, regardless of the economic impact, to strike for a political demand, such as the resignation of the president. So under all of those conditions, the leaders of that strike would have been in jail a long time ago in the United States. This is a country that relies on oil for 80% of its export earnings and half of its government revenue, and it's really, really hurt the economy. It lost probably 6 to 10% of GDP as a result. We've never had anything like that.
You know, Mark, if all the journalists from the major U.S. news media that cover Venezuela acknowledge this point to you, why are the Americans so uninformed? Why is the journalism not conveying these truths to the American people so we can have a better sense of formulating a proper policy?
Yeah, that's the question, you know, you have to ask them. I can't tell you, you know, I have just a certain amount of experience in talking with journalists and editors, and so I can only say what I've observed. You know, very often it is the editors, for example. There are all kinds of other pressures, which I'm sure you've talked about and written about, actually. You know, the pressures that they have in trying to get sources and get the right people to talk to them, and their own prejudices as well.
I mean, were these journalists frustrated with the situation or resigned to it?
Actually, we were frustrated in some ways. For example, they confronted that's another thing that hasn't got a lot of press here, but the TV media there is absolutely atrocious. It's not like, you know.
Well, we wouldn't know anything about bad TV news in this country.
No, but really, no, Bob, it's nothing like that. It's not like that. It's 100 times worse. It's openly partisan. It's openly, you know, they'll try and convince people that Chavez is responsible for murder, and they'll put bloody bodies on the TV and the grieving relatives, and you know, just shameless lying and everything. And this is and all the TV except for one station, the public TV station, is controlled by the opposition. And so it's much worse than we would ever tolerate. For instance, here we wouldn't have an election, for example, where, you know, one party controlled, you know, all the stations, right? And so, and the print media and the radio is similar. And so the journalists actually confronted, while I was down there, they confronted the owners of the TV, and they said, you know, you can't do this. You're going to lose all your credibility. And, of course, they didn't get it at all. You know, they said, hey, you know, you did this during Watergate. You went after the Nixon administration, right? This is their idea. No concept that you're supposed to at least follow the norms of objectivity. And so they are frustrated in that sense. Are they frustrated with their own papers? I really, you know, I can't speak for them. I think, I don't really know. I can't really tell you how they really think about this. I mean, sometimes they do change. Under pressure or under, you know, people give them more information, especially on the economic issues.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot today. Mark, we've only got a minute or two left. Maybe what you could do, unless there's something else you'd like to talk about, is give a sense of what media you consume yourself to stay on top of issues. What does Mark Weisbrot's media diet look like?
Well, I try to read everything. I mean, we have to read all the New York Times, Washington Post every week just to do our work. We read, you know, most of the mainstream sources. One really nice thing that picks up all the good stuff in the mainstream media as well as the alternative press is the commondreams.org. That's a very nice kind of summary. And then the critical literature, the fairness and accuracy in reporting, their Extra, for example.
And their website, I think, is fair.org.
You get, you know, for the criticism. For information, there are a lot of good websites now.
I think I hear the band tuning up in the background, Mark, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. Why don't we give us your website one last time?
Sure. It's www.ceper.net. It's the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
And I'd like to thank Mark Weisbrot for being our guest today. I'll be back one week from today with Mike Farrell and Robert Greenwald. Until then, I'd like to thank you all for joining us in Media Matters. And again, Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.